This is the rain report for the week beginning Saturday, May 21, 2005. While we're at the Hamvention having fun this weekend, you're going to get to hear a rerun from May 1991. It's an interview with Larry Magny, at that time the editor of Passport to World Band Radio, and the phenomena that Desert Storm created for shortwave manufacturers and shortwave publishers. Here's that interview.
This is a Rain Weekly Spotlight, Shortwave Comes of Age. I'm Hap Holly, JC9RP in Chicago. While SWLN, shortwave listening, has grown in popularity over the years, never has it enjoyed such mass appeal as it does today. Just try to buy a copy of Passport to World Band Radio. Larry Magny is its editor-in-chief.
We founded the Passport to World Band Radio as a publishing exercise. The company itself has been in existence for some other years, but we did engineering consulting to overseas broadcasters, and we found that we have a rather unique database of international broadcasts on the air that we had derived from monitoring in various parts of the world, and we were keeping this up to date for frequency management purposes, and we said, what the heck, you know, this could be turned around and very useful for the public. So it was almost an afterthought. We came out with what we then called Radio Database International, and a very slim edition, only covered the tropical bands, in January of 1984. And it was a real seller. I think it did something like 300 copies. And we thought, well, it may not be much, but we saw a future here. And so in 85, we came out with a larger two-volume set called Radio Database International. And it was an 85-86 edition, and that seemed to do nicely. So the next year, we combined the two into one volume, same name, and that seemed to do very nicely, too. So the following year, we changed the name to Passport to World Band Radio. That was with the 1988 edition. And this year, we're at the end of January, and the 1991 edition, we've already printed 80,000, sold about 53,000. And we fully expect to sell the rest and maybe then some. So it's been a real nice curve, and just goes to show that there's public interest in shortwave radio.
According to a story I heard recently, that you may or you are going to go into a second printing.
We are, yes. It's in a second printing. We printed 55,000 in the first printing, and we figured we might have to do a small second printing, but we weren't sure. It's very hard to gauge when it's growing this fast exactly how many books you're going to have. So anyway, we were chugging along, and of course the Gulf situation came along, and Zoom. In one day, in fact 2 days, Monday and Tuesday of last week, that was right not long after the war started, we sent 10,000 books out of here in 2 days. So obviously if we did that every day, we would be competing with the Old Testament for sales. But, of course, that was just a blip. But still, the long-term curve is very strong. And the advantage that this blip is having is it's creating a lot of interest in the field, not just with us, but, you know, with hands as well. It's stories very often to deal with shortwave listening, like there was one in the Columbus Journal the other day and mentioned about shortwave listening that went into, you know, the role that hands are playing. So the two often go together, as they always have. And the League is certainly selling an awful lot of books. In fact, we just, an hour ago, sent another big shipment by truck out to them. So they're selling a lot of books to hams. And it's a kind of a mutual thing. It's always been a going together between the two fields. And I'm hoping not only are we getting more shortwave listeners, but I'm hoping and expecting that this is going to help the ham community grow. And that, and, of course, the no-code license.
Did the breakout of the military action on January 15th, that really didn't start it, though, did it? This has really been coming on for a couple of years, hasn't it? Shortwave listening has come of its own?
Yes. In fact, we provided some data to USA Today last Friday, which they printed in. As I recall, essentially, it's better than doubled or more or less doubled in the last 5 years. And the rate of increase is definitely increasing. For example, maybe we went up 20% in our sales 1 year and 30% in another and 40% in another, and now we're doing like 100%. So it's not just an increase, but it's almost exponential. And it does suggest that the real situation in the U.S. is that people have not known about the field. And as what we, one of the things we do as far as hamming goes, in the book we try to explain to people what the field is, how to get started and so forth, and also direct them and to make them knowledgeable about the fact hamming exists. We don't pretend to be a ham reference, obviously we're not, but, you know, we let them know that there's this world out there, and if they're interested, you know, they can go out and do this, that, and the other.
Interesting. Are you getting much business from abroad, or do you normally anyway?
No, most of, we do get business abroad, but most of, the overwhelming majority of our sales is in, are in the United States and Canada. I don't remember off the top of my head the percentage, but we do fairly well in the United Kingdom, too, and in Japan. In continental Europe, it's somewhat more traditional. Now, over there, we haven't really tried real hard to get into Europe, but I suspect that the ground isn't quite as fertile. There seems to be a certain mindset on the part of Americans. Americans are, interestingly enough, Americans are turning outward over the last several years. They're looking at the world around them, and they want to communicate with and know more about the world around them. Meanwhile, Europeans are turning inward. You see, they're trying to become a United States of Europe. So the mental outlook of the population is much more amenable to international communications in this country than it is in Western Europe. Even in the UK, where we do well, we're basically catching the traditional hobby and DX listeners and hams that are already established, as opposed to what we're seeing in North America, which is a totally new growth market. I mean, people were getting, sure, many of them are established, maybe a third, I don't know. We really aren't certain, but it's maybe a half, somewhere in there. Oh, the people are already established by the book, but the part that's interesting is the half that is not established. And these are people that are brand new. And we did some analysis on that. We found that after a year, these people are still there. We thought there'd be a dropout rate, but essentially those people stay with it. So it's building up a whole new growing base of people. And as far as hamming goes, we don't know what the percentage is, but we know there is a certain percent that sooner or later, after they've listened for a long time and so forth, a certain portion of them will want to get involved in hamming. So we're expecting that this is going to have an afterglow positive effect on hamming. How much, I don't know, but I'm sure it will.
This is the Rain Weekly Spotlight, Shortwave Comes of Age, Part 1, an interview with Larry Magny, Editor-in-Chief of Passport to World Band Radio, a guide to SWLN shortwave listening that appears to be headed for the bestseller list of 1991. More from Magny after a pause for station ID. This is Rain, the Radio Amateur Information Network.
You're listening to RainReport.com, the only authorized internet source for Rain audio.
As a sidebar, what do you think NoCode is going to do for the future of amateur radio, if anything?
I think it will help. How much, I don't know. I speak as someone who would have been a ham had it not been for code. I just couldn't put up with it when I was younger. I didn't have the patience for it. And not that I'm against code. There's obvious advantages to code. But I think the idea of having the ability to bring in people where you don't have to learn code, as long as code doesn't wind up getting shunted off to the side. I think there's a real need to make sure that this doesn't wind up becoming the AM radio of hamming. But I think also, if we're going to get fresh blood in there, it's not just numbers and that kind of thing, but it's also the idea that there's more people involved, there's going to be more excitement in the field, there's going to be more manufacturers turning out better and wider range of products, and I'm not sure I see a downside, although I know there's some of my colleagues disagree, and I'm not as close to it as they are, but as long as it doesn't get to be a thing where everybody that comes in is no code and code fades away, I think it would be a good thing.
Getting back to what you do, is the Passport to World Band Radio the only publication you have today?
It's the only major publication we have today. We have about, I think, 15, give or take, monographs that are, there are full findings from our receive reviews, those reviews that are of equipment that's fairly costly. For example, the tabletops, that's made by ICOM and Kenwood and Japan Radio and so forth. and also some of the more expensive portables. The reasoning being that if somebody's buying a $200 plastic portable, what they see in Passport's buyer's guide is more than enough for what they need. It tells them the rating and the advantages, disadvantages. When they're spending $1,000, they're going to want more information. So just as originally it was just a public service type of thing, we photocopied. Well, we put all our information we found from our lab tests, our panelists, and all the little bits and pieces. We kind of made it sensible and in clear English and put it together into these things and stapled them together and put them out more or less at cost. And then we found that, you know, instead of 100 or 200 of these going out, there were thousands of them going out. So essentially, we do a lot of those, but it's not, they're not what you'd normally call a publication, kind of thin, you know, 15, 30, 35 pages each, and I don't think you'd say they contribute to our financial largesse terribly, because they're a pain to put together. They take a lot of people's time, and they cost fairly high to print, and if we sell them to dealers, which we often do, that's, I guess, where most of it goes, then, of course, you've got that. So the end result is it's not financially all that attractive, but it's one of those good things. It doesn't hurt us. It's like chicken soup. And it helps people when they're making decisions and buying.
You're sort of a success story in that at one time you were a regular 9-to-5er behind the desk, I gather.
Yeah.
7 years ago, you began what you're doing today, and now you're doing it full-time.
Well, actually, the company itself, the origins of the company go back 20 years. I decided to poke into the field and found that there was an awful lot I thought could be done better, frankly. And frequency management appealed to me. And I got involved in that, and I got involved in some engineering stuff, and that was really our bread and butter for a long time. It wasn't a big lucrative type of thing, but it was enough to justify the time and so forth, and the results were quite pleasing. We did some counter jamming work and things of that nature in addition. And long and short of it is that that we were very pleased with that. It was a nice operation and a small but very happy team. It was sort of like being paid for DXing, you know, and everybody was quite pleased. But then we found the market was thin, and we lost a couple of clients very close to each other without any kind of warning. These were government clients, and there's not much you could do about it. It was just political changes. So we decided that to heck with this. This is a perilous existence, and rather than keep trying to pursue that, we had this database, as I mentioned, anyway, and we thought, well, let's see if we can kind of spread our manure out a little bit here by offering this as a publication. So the company actually goes back about 20 years, but the publishing end of it only goes back about 7.
Do you see the whole shortwave hobby popularity craze leveling off soon, or do you think it's just going to continue to proliferate like crazy?
Well, I think I'm certain that it's not going to continue as it did 9 or 10 days ago when there was a feeding frenzy of radios. I mean, you just can't buy any now. We get people calling and we whisper in their ears. It's almost like a black market at this point. And the saddest thing is the manufacturers are not all, but many of them are fast asleep. They just could care less. Absolutely, it's pathetic. But there are some that they're on their toes, and hopefully they will address the market better in the future. But in any event, what we have seen and what we've heard from others in the field is that the market took an enormous rise about 10 days ago. It just unprecedented. It was a madness there for a couple of days. It tapered off considerably, but it's been holding up well since. And I think as long as the war is there, it's going to continue to hold up well. Another thing, these people who bought these radios, some may drop out. We don't know. We've never been through a war situation before, but I strongly suspect that the vast majority will stick with it. So those people, of course, are going to need equipment. They're going to keep buying books. So I don't think that things will taper off. We have that long-term growth rate that's been there all along. That's not going to go away. So with all the publicity and everything else, my guess is that it's going to have for all the unfortunate things that this war has brought about and will continue to, there are always, you know, little silver flecks on even the darkest cloud. And I think here, the American people have shown they're very interested in knowing what's going on beyond their borders. And I think that is a socially very important thing for us to have happen. What you guys are doing is a variant of the same thing. And hamming has always been you know, not only just a hobby and rag chewing, but it's always had that sense of, you know, people trying to reach out and communicate with each other, whether it be across borders or across the town. And I think it's a terribly important thing. And a number of our staff are hams. It's a kind of an ironic situation. But I've always I've always felt that the two fields, on one hand, we've suffered from hamming in the sense that people say, shortwave listening, oh, you're a ham. So we've tried to make sure that people realize that there's a difference, because it's hard to explain what the facts are when people don't understand what you're talking about. On the other hand, there's definitely a body politic among shortwave listeners that becomes hams, and with the general coverage receivers that are transceivers, which are so common now, there's a growing number of hams that are becoming SWLs as well. And it, to me, this is the kind of thing that's really beneficial. Everybody's coming out ahead, and I don't see a downside.
This has been a RAIN Weekly Spotlight, Shortwave Comes of Age, Part 1. I spoke with Larry Magny, Editor-in-Chief of Passport to World Band Radio, a shortwave publication that seems destined to become a bestseller for 1991. I'm Hap Holly, KC9RP in Chicago. The RAIN Weekly Spotlight is a production of RAIN, the Radio Amateur Information Network.
And that's it for this RAIN report. This rerun was copyright 1990-2005, RAIN, all rights reserved. I'm Hap Holly, KC9RP in Chicago, looking forward to bringing you the first excerpt from the 2005 Dayton Hamvention next week.